Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Nicole Foss, a lecturer and writer who tackles issues of financial and energy collapse, and who provides a vision for the future to make any eventual fall less severe for those who prepare. Her goals for each of us go beyond just the self, but also to our communities. My production assistant, James, suggested Nicole as a guest and sent me a link to an interview she did with James Howard Kunstler of the Kunstler Cast. As she talks about finance, a big world I won't pretend to understand, as well as energy decline, something I haven't covered in any great detail, this interview seemed inevitable. After playing tag for a few months while she's been on her whirlwind tour, we finally had a chance to connect. During the interview, she covers financial and energy contraction in great detail. I say that she does this because these topics are outside my normal purview, and I didn't see a reason to interject my own take very often. I'm thankful for her thorough understanding of her position, her articulate explanation of the what and why on these topics, and being gracious with me while I played catch-up during the conversation. Just another reason why I'm a podcaster, and don't release live, rough interviews. Nicole was in the Netherlands when we recorded this interview. I wouldn't have been able to afford to make that call if it wasn't for your ongoing support of the show. The small recurring monthly and one-time donations from you keep this show on the air and continually growing. One of my next investments is going to be in a portable field recorder. Specifically, I'm looking at a Tascam DR100 Mark II, so I can take the show on the road and do more in-person interviews. You can find out how to help by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support, and I'll be glad that you did. While you're there, you can also find out how to like the show on Facebook or connect with me on Twitter. Now then, on to the interview with Nicole Foss. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates. Well then, Nicole, if you're ready, if you could give us a little bit of your background and biography, how you came to do what you do, and then we'll talk about peak oil and the potential looming financial crisis.
Well, it's been a long and complicated journey to get to doing what I do now. I've always been interested in the big picture. So I've always been interested in how does the world work in the most comprehensive possible way. And that started off with doing biology. In the first week I was in a biology degree program, my professor said, if you want to understand the problems of the world, study biology. If you want to do something about it, study something else. So I did biology, environmental science, and 2 law degrees, because I wanted to know not only how, you know, what the biological issues were, what the physical limits were, but I wanted to understand the human mechanisms for dealing with things as well, and the ways that we interacted with our natural world and natural capital. And so after that, I thought, well, I can't really say I understand the world if I don't understand how money works, because it's so clearly related to power relationships. And there's so much about how the world actually works in practice, realpolitik, if you like, that hinges on enormous flows of money in the world. So I decided some 20 years ago that I needed to understand money as well. So I've been working on that for a long time. I was a research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. So I was working in all kinds of energy issues, particularly nuclear safety in Eastern Europe. But I also have a background in doing all kinds of other things in the intersection between energy and science and energy and law, looking at things like the environmental impact of power generation or power system regulation or nuclear safety regulation, and a whole series of issues around that. And I latterly ran the Agri-Energy Producers Association of Ontario, looking at grid connections for renewable energy. So I have a background in bioenergy and all kinds of renewables and how they fit into a grid system. But really, the idea at the moment with what I do is to try and pull everything together. I've been trying to do that since late 2005. I started off writing at the Oil Drum, which was a peak oil website, and then the people who run the Oil Drum asked me to run a Canadian version of it. So I was developing a work on Canadian energy, energy in general, and also how that all fitted into the financial context and the environmental context as well. They eventually decided that they wanted to purely focus on energy, so I moved on and with my writing partner set up the Automatic Earth in early 2008. And since then, we've been looking at the biggest possible big picture. So it's finance, it's energy, it's population and carrying capacity and resource limits and environmental capacity to absorb externalities and climate and human collective psychology and all kinds of different responses to the way things actually work. The idea is to look at each different subsystem of reality and knit them all together in order to really come up with that biggest possible big picture. So that's what the Automatic Earth is all about and has been for the last 5.5 years. It's been, how do you look at how reality actually works? Embrace complexity. Don't try and simplify things to the point where you can't really adequately describe anything, but embrace complexity, but then try to make it comprehensible and communicate that complexity to anyone who would be interested, based on understanding how different subsystems work, how they fit together, and what are the time constants for change in each different subsystem in order to be able to prioritize action in terms of preparedness for limits to growth, in terms of what comes first, what has the largest impact, what kind of impact is it, what time frame does it operate over, and how does each limiting factor then cascade into other limits that we're facing. So how does it all fit together? That's really the task at the moment.
So if I'm following that correctly, because that's a whole lot of information for me to try to take in a moment, you're taking the reductionist pieces of these different systems and then assembling them into a cohesive narrative framework in order to explain not only what's happening, but also how to bring about change within that larger narrative?
Yes, essentially. It is a very complex narrative. It does have a whole lot of different subsets, and so complexity is absolutely inevitably part of it.
Yeah, I imagine when you have that many pieces, where one turns, it affects another, and that kind of cascades across the system. When you're looking at this, where are you finding some of the leverage points, both for where the problems are occurring and where people can bring about change?
Well, the critical subsystem at the moment is the financial system, because not because it's the most important thing in the world, but because it's the thing that is going critical first. That's happening right now. In fact, it has been for the last several years, and it's picking up momentum in a large swing of positive feedback to the downside. This, because it has such a short time constant for change, it is going to act as the primary driver of contraction. So it's the first limit we hit, the impact is substantial, and that impact plays out over a relatively short space of time. So this is why the Automatic Earth is primarily known as a finance website, because that is our primary focus, because of the short time frame. So what we're looking at is a scenario of the next several years being a period of acute financial crisis. Then we're going to see the next set of hurdles. So if you like, we can think of this as a race of hurdles where we have to get over each one as they appear, but we have to know which ones are coming up and how to get over each one successively. Finance is the first hurdle. Energy is probably the second. After that, it depends where in the world you live and what the local circumstances actually are as to what the limiting factors will be. But we really are looking at limits to growth manifesting at a very large scale over the next several decades. So finance is simply the first part of the picture, the thing that hits first, and the thing that we have to prepare for first. So what we're needing to prepare for in the relatively short term is an enormous financial crisis, a loss of confidence in the banking system, the loss of virtual value that had been accorded to promises to repay, which crashes the credit system and gets us into the heart of an enormous debt crisis. And if we want to know what that looks like, we only have to look at parts of the European periphery today. And I'd be more than happy to explain exactly what that looks like and how that manifests in various parts of the world.
Well, thank you for offering that. That was going to be my next question, if you'd like to go ahead and proceed with that.
Well, what I've been doing lately on my lecture tours is really doing a kind of world tour to say what is going on in all these different parts of the world. The global financial system is incredibly interconnected. So what happens in one part of it is going to have knock-on effects in other parts. The focus right now is the European periphery. So what's happening and what has been happening for the last several years is an extreme economic contraction. So places like Greece and Spain are already in the heart of economic depression. The money supply is crashing. The asset markets are crashing. They're on the verge of or already have declared credit events in terms of sovereign debt default. Not necessarily declared credit events according to the market, but there have been huge haircuts on bond holdings in places like Greece. The next step is to look at Cyprus, where within 1 week, Cyprus went back about 50 years. The banks closed, the ATMs were empty, it became a cash-only economy in the space of a week. So you had to have cash in order to purchase anything from a shop, but there may not have been anything in shops because the suppliers also demanded cash from the shopkeepers. This is what happens when a financial crisis hits in the very short term. So you end up with a complete loss of confidence in the banking system. And the reason that manifested in Cyprus was that their banking system was 800% of the size of their entire economy. So it was similar to Iceland and Ireland before it. Now, the way to think of this is to think of a bucket with a certain amount of water in it. And you can imagine that as being the European banking system. Now, there's a hole in the bottom of the bucket, and there has been for several years with what's been going on in Greece and Spain and Ireland and Portugal and Italy. But the European Central Bank has been topping up the level of water in that bucket so that the flow rates in and out were about the same, and the amount of water in the bucket didn't change that much. But with what just happened in Cyprus, with the enormous crash in the banking system there, the hole in the bottom of the bucket just got an awful lot bigger than it was before. And I don't think the European Central Bank is going to top up the flow rate in at the top of the bucket. In other words, we have a big problem, because not only is there a loss of confidence in the banking system in Cyprus, but now you have British politicians telling their compatriots to get their money out of Spain while they still can. So this contagion, if you like, the financial contagion, is spreading throughout the periphery, the European periphery banking system. So because the system is so interconnected with the rest of the world, this is going to have knock-on effects. People are no longer believing in deposit guarantees, for instance, because of what they tried to do in Cyprus to haircut the guaranteed deposits. They've already said in Europe that bank bail-ins using depositors' funds will be the model for future banks that get into trouble, and there are banks that are on the verge of getting into trouble throughout the European Union. Now, the US, the UK, Canada, and New Zealand have all said that they also will include legislation for bank bail-ins, dealing with the depositors' funds as the first line of defense against bank failures. So we can already see that in most of the developed world, this will be the response to future banking crises. So deposit guarantees are not worth the paper they're written on. And when we do have a systemic banking crisis, which is probably quite close, then we are going to have a major problem. That is going to crash the money supply, and then we're not going to be able to afford very much of anything, very much the way people in Greece and Cyprus find themselves today. And this, of course, has effects in China and Australia and New Zealand, all over the world. This has knock-on effects not only in the world of finance, but in the real economy as well.
And you see this not a matter of if, but when, and that when is relatively close.
That when is indeed relatively close. We're already seeing momentum pick up in Europe. So Cyprus was within the last 3 months, but there's going to be a lot more that comes along from that. There are a lot of other places that are offshore banking centers that also have disproportionate banking sectors compared to the size of the host economy. The entire banking sector in Europe is over-leveraged, disproportionate, and overexposed to sovereign debt. And that sovereign debt is very likely to blow up in their faces in the not-too-distant future, largely thanks to the straitjacket of the European single currency, which has no future. But in the meantime, the attempt to adhere to that single currency regime is absolutely crippling the countries of the European periphery and leading them into sovereign debt default and an enormous banking crisis.
So the single currency model for the European Union is not sustainable?
Oh, not even remotely. The architecture is fundamentally flawed. There's an enormous disparity between the level of governance that deals with the currency, which is the transnational level, and the level of primary loyalty, which is the national level within Europe. So Europeans do not see themselves as primarily European. They see themselves as French or Italian or German. It's quite different from the US, where you have a genuine currency union, where you have a genuine single currency, because people don't think of themselves as primarily Connecticutans or Massachusettsans or Californians. They see themselves as American, primarily. So there's no disparity between the level of primary loyalty and the level that deals with the currency. That's just not the case in Europe. Plus, in Europe, you can actually distinguish between euros that come from different places. All you need to do is look at the serial number and you can tell which country printed that particular euro. That allows for differentiation between different euros at some point in the future. And already in Germany, Germans prefer to have German euros, which have a serial number that begins with an X, rather than euros printed in the periphery. And in Cyprus, already you can argue that a euro in the bank in Cyprus is not worth the same as a euro on the continent, because the range of things you can do with it is substantially constrained by Cypriot capital controls. So I don't think you have a single currency in Europe. I think you have a glorified currency peg. And when you have a currency peg in times of upheaval, all that does is create something for the speculators to attack. They will have a field day, and they will take down the single currency. Now, they have a history of doing this. If you look at the European exchange rate mechanism, which was the precursor to the single currency, George Soros made $1 billion in a day when he bet against the ability of the British government to maintain the pound within the boundaries allowed by the exchange rate mechanism. He bet against the pound, and he made an enormous amount of money when he managed to drive the pound out of the exchange rate mechanism in the early 1990s. I think the single currency is going to come under the same attack. It's already acted as a straitjacket, which has contained internal tensions for a number of years, while those internal tensions built and built and built. The problem is, when you have a strong centralizing force that takes that kind of role, when that centralizing force finally fails, then the entire thing just blows up because of all the tensions that have built. Now, the analogy that I see with this is really Yugoslavia in the early 1990s. If you look at the strong central role played by Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia, he was containing within a single political entity an enormous amount of tension. And when he died and that tension was released, the result really was an enormous amount of conflict. I think Europe as a whole looks an awful lot like Yugoslavia in a way. So I would think that the future for Europe is really some form of balkanization, some form of division, that the European single currency was intended to reduce the potential for conflict in the future. I think it's actually set up a future that's going to have more conflict in it than it would otherwise have done, because we blurred the borders between these different countries, allowed the tensions to build up as if these countries were the same when economically they're enormously different. We allowed those tensions to build up, but now when that central force finally falls, all those tensions will blow up and all those differences between different countries will come to the fore again. You can see it happening already. The enormous mutual recriminations between places like Germany and Greece, where the Germans will, for instance, say to the Greeks, well, you're lazy and you don't pay taxes and it's all your fault. You spent more money than you could afford. And the Greeks will turn around and say to the Germans, you were predatory lenders, just like those subprime lenders in the United States. So you just wanted us to buy BMWs, so you got us into this single currency and dangled all these sweet things in front of our noses, and of course we went out and bought them. Now, I would say in both those cases, there's some element of truth to those perspectives, but do either of those perspectives help at all? Absolutely not. All they do is build mutual recrimination, and that's the last thing in the world Europe should be looking at. Europe should be saying, we're in a marriage here. We came together for better or for worse. Let's make it work. But they're not. What you're seeing is countries going back to their own national perspective. The collective perspective is being lost. And when you lose that collective perspective and nobody is defending the collective anymore, you have fragmentation by definition. And my concern is that that fragmentation, because it will go so deep into the fabric of European economies and societies, that's going to just lead to an enormous amount of extremely unhelpful mutual recrimination.
So then that sets in place the downfall of the European Union and the single currency and a fallback to a more nationalistic perspective?
Yes, very much so. But it doesn't stay in Europe. If you look at what's happening in the United States, there is a wall being approached in finance in the United States as well. It's not so much at the federal level, but at the state and the municipal level, where they cannot print money, they cannot monetize debt. And states and municipalities almost across the board are approaching that limit where they're having to constantly borrow money, but it's getting harder and harder to borrow money to fill their budget gaps. And the federal government and the Federal Reserve are constantly trying to kick the can down the road, but it only works for a certain amount of time. When you no longer have willing borrowers and lenders, you can't really do that anymore. So eventually, quantitative easing will end up being abandoned. Already things have been getting tighter and tighter in the United States. It's just that not a critical mass of people have fallen off the back of the bus yet, but they are going to. And so we're going to see the U.S. move into economic depression as well. And it will take Canada with it, since Canada exports 80% of everything they make to the United States. And then you start to look at other parts of the world where China is also experiencing the bursting of an enormous credit bubble. They've been drawing in commodities from all over the world like there's no tomorrow for years and years and years, but they have grossly overbuilt infrastructure. They've already stockpiled everything, which means that their demand for commodities will be a lot less. Their debt bubble is going to burst. Their asset markets will collapse. This, of course, has knock-on effects for countries that export to China, like Australia and New Zealand, for instance. So we're going to see problems in the mining sector in Australia, along with the inevitable banking crisis that will happen in all these countries as well. So we really are facing limits to growth on a global scale, and this is approaching fairly soon. We're at the moment at a kind of peak of optimism where everyone has gone back to sleep again. They think that the financial crisis of 2008 is over, and we don't have anything to worry about anymore, so we can just enjoy the optimism that comes with Ben Bernanke saving the world. But unfortunately, the world is not like that, and we are actually on the verge of a very significant crisis. The things that people tend to understand, the energy and environmental aspects to limits to growth, those are actually not going to be the limits that we hit first. We're going to be dealing with financial limits first. That will buy us a little bit of time in terms of these various other subsystems. But it doesn't mean that those other extremely non-negotiable limits are going to go away. We are going to be dealing with those in their turn as well. It might put them off by 10 years, perhaps, depending on where in the world you live. But we really are dealing with an awful lot of challenges, and people need to think in terms of how they can deal with a substantially different future, how they can deal with a future where there's a lot less money in circulation, a lot less available energy, a lot less available resources, and having to live within a much simpler society. So if you look at the ability to maintain socioeconomic complexity, it critically depends on cheap energy and cheap money, both of which are not going to be part of the future. So we will inevitably be living with a simpler civilization. I think we need to look at long and hard about what that means and embrace that in advance, because if we do that in advance and we make an adjustment towards living that way now, then we will not find that we have anything like the same impact on our lives as would otherwise be the case.
It's interesting for me in this conversation when you talk about the United States and what we're facing, because I live in Pennsylvania outside the state capital, and the city of Harrisburg has been in a state of financial crisis for some time, and its debt has effectively shut it out of the municipal debt market in order to borrow additional money. So it's trying to figure out ways to proceed. And just the other day, I was sitting down with a friend of mine who works in the financial market, and he told me that the company that he works for was just recently declared too big to fail. And it wasn't something that I ever heard in the news, but it was something that came through his company that they're now in that state in the United States. And I look at that and I just wonder, well, how many other companies haven't I heard about that the government is going to be ready to transfer money to keep them active, regardless of what kind of improprieties that they may have or may suffer from some of the poor choices that they've made?
Well, that's absolutely endemic in the United States and elsewhere as well. too big to fail does not actually mean that you can't fail. It just means that when you inevitably do, it's going to hurt an awful lot more. And it will hurt more if governments have tried to prop up companies like this in the meantime, because that's just throwing good money after bad. Nothing too big to fail should ever be allowed to exist, really. Too big to fail is too big to exist by definition, because it means that these companies pose a systemic risk. So I think a lot of these things will ultimately fail, whether we like it or not. What the governments are trying to do at the moment is kick the can down the road, to paper over the cracks, keep some of these larger entities afloat for as long as they can. It doesn't mean, however, that they can rescue them. It only means that they might be able to kick the can down the road into somebody else's term of office, so then when the inevitable failure happens, they can blame it on somebody else. Unfortunately, politics really is that unedifying. There's very little to do with actually rescuing things or changing scenarios, and that is simply beyond the capacity that the governments have to deliver. They do not have the potential to prevent an enormous financial contraction from happening, because we've already had the bubble, we've already created the scenario where we have this enormous amount of illusory wealth, and we think that it's real, but it's not. It's a bit like Enron, if you remember Enron from a few years ago. It looked like a giant, robust international company until 2 weeks before it ceased to exist altogether because it imploded, and it had been entirely hollowed out. So what looked to the exterior like something substantial actually had no substance to it left at all by the time it collapsed. The whole derivatives market looks like that today. And it has a notional value of somewhere around $250 billion. So there is an absolutely staggering amount of illusory wealth out there. A lot of these things that appear too big to fail only appear as big as they are. In reality, there is very little substance, but that doesn't mean that their failure doesn't have a huge impact. And certainly in places like Pennsylvania, a lot of that impact is being felt already. There's a tremendous amount of urban decay in the Northeast, in the area that was the industrial productive heartland once of the manufacturing industry. And places like Detroit and Pennsylvania all have things in common in terms of infrastructure that was developed to provide for manufacturing that no longer exists. And that does provide a huge overhang on these places. I drove through Pennsylvania last year and really saw the kind of decay that exists there. The same thing in Detroit, the heart of the worst urban decay I've ever seen in my life. A lot of that is going to end up being written off, and eventually we will end up doing something different instead. But all the investments in the history of manufacturing there are not going to come to anything. So there's a big restart that has to happen in the Northeast in particular.
If I remember right, I'm sure that I don't have these numbers correct, but it's Pennsylvania has the third largest roads and bridges infrastructure in the country, but its budget is 12th for actually maintaining that. And I get to see that decay for the number of bridges that are currently considered structurally deficient, and some of the repairs that are going on and all the decisions that are being made to just close certain sections of road down to no longer be used. And I also think it's funny that you mentioned Enron. When I was coming out of university for the first time, I had a friend who was trying to get me hired with them and to move to Texas to work at their corporate office. I'm glad I didn't make that decision.
You're quite right about the infrastructure lack of maintenance in Pennsylvania, and not just Pennsylvania, but very much more broadly than that. A lot of this infrastructure dates to about the same era, when there was a lot of money around and a lot of building was going on in this sort of flush of enthusiasm in the 50s and 60s. Almost all of that is reaching the end of its design life now. There's no money to maintain it. Responsibility for maintaining it has been downloaded to lower and lower levels of political organization, but it's been downloaded without any funding for actually doing the maintenance. The same in Canada as well. Bridges are starting to collapse because responsibility for maintaining them has been downloaded so far that now the chances of there even being any people employed to perform that task at the level that has the responsibility is very low. The chances of there being any budget for performing any of that maintenance is even lower. So essentially what we're waiting for is for bridges to fall down. And I do think that we're going to see various forms of infrastructure closed down. We couldn't even rebuild New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And there are other examples in other parts of the world where relatively rich countries are not able to restore places after that level of damage. They simply sit there in their destroyed form for a very long time. So this is really symptomatic of the fact that we're at the top of a bubble, that we no longer have the capacity we had in the 50s and 60s to actually build and maintain infrastructure. Now we're left with a legacy of infrastructure that's crumbling and no resources left to deal with it.
It seems a little insurmountable at times, thinking about how big the problem is.
Well, it does, but essentially what we have to do is just say, that was then and this is now. What can we do now that can still work? I think we need to stage a large-scale retreat from being as overextended as we are now, having the full range of structural dependencies we have now, to say, how can we retreat from that and live within a kind of social construct that can actually work, that is simpler, that is more local, that allows us to do things in a way where we're not dependent on these large-scale national and international scale life support systems, because it is those that are failing. It's not our capacity to exist as human beings that's actually under threat. We can grow our own food. We can build very simple dwellings. We don't necessarily have to have electricity for anything like the range of things we currently use it for. We can transport ourselves in far more local areas without any reliance on fossil fuels at all. There's a lot that is doable, but industrial civilization is not doable, I'm afraid, because that's what depends on cheap credit and cheap energy. We need to think about positioning ourselves for a very different kind of future, one that doesn't look like the past, but the one that is doable within the resource constraints that we're going to have.
I'd like to touch on that idea some more, but before walking down that path, we've covered the first of the crises that you see looming ahead of us with the financial, that one that's on the near horizon. You mentioned as the second also an energy crunch. Could you touch on that some more?
Yes, certainly. Well, we're at the moment at approximately the peak of oil production globally, within a few years either side. Now, people tend to have taken their focus off peak oil in recent years, because of all the unconventional energy sources that have got a lot of airtime recently. So people are putting all their confidence in shale oil and shale gas and oil shale and various forms of renewable energy, as if we could run a complete power system on intermittent renewable energy alone. So people have this sense that it doesn't matter if we're running out of oil, because we have plenty of alternatives and we can just do everything we have been used to doing, but we'll do it in different ways with different energy sources. But those energy sources are actually not comparable. The main reason that they're not comparable is something called energy returned on energy invested, or the energy profit ratio. What that is how much energy do you get out compared to what you had to put in to get it. If you look at the energy profit ratio for the oil industry, in the early days, it was of the order of 100 to 1. That means if you invest a unit of energy in energy production, you would expect to get 100 units in return. Now, globally, it's perhaps 15 to 1. But if you look at all the alternatives on average in terms of energy profit ratio, they're perhaps a factor of 10 lower than that. Now, if you lower your energy profit ratio by a factor of 10, you would have to multiply gross production by a factor of 10 just to have the same amount of energy available to society that it currently has. But we are not going to be multiplying gross production by a factor of 10. Gross production is flat to falling, and energy profit ratio is falling substantially as well. What that means is we will have very, very much less energy available for society's purposes than we currently have. And in fact, because energy supply determines our ability to maintain socioeconomic complexity, when we have a lot less energy, it will inevitably mean we cannot maintain our current level of complex society. We will be forced to simplify. Now, simple societies, while being perfectly doable in their own way, simple societies do not frack, they do not drill horizontally, they do not mine for rare earth metals or produce concrete and rebar or solar panels and things like that. So the implication is that these low energy profit ratio energy sources will not actually be an energy source in the future. Right now, we can only exploit them because we still have access to high energy profit ratio conventional fossil fuels. All these unconventional alternatives rely on the continued availability of cheap energy to be able to produce and exploit them. But when we no longer have that cheap energy, then we will find that our society will simplify and we will no longer be able to engage in these extremely complex activities. So these unconventional sources are not an energy source now, and they won't be in the future either because we will no longer have the ability to exploit them at all. We won't be able to put a huge amount of energy into them up front in order to get the same amount of energy out at the other end. This is really absolutely critical that we are going to be looking at drastically less energy in the future than we are now. All of these unconventional energy sources are essentially a mirage. They're a way for a few people to make a lot of money today by generating enough hype that a lot of people will throw money at them. And then it doesn't really matter from their point of view if no amount of energy ever really materializes from these sources because they got paid up front for making the attempt to produce energy. Unfortunately, people getting paid up front and leaving other people to hold the empty bag is exactly what has got us into trouble in the world of finance and in so many other ways. It amounts to turning your economy into a Ponzi scheme so that the few people who get in early and get out early benefit enormously, but they leave everyone else holding the empty bag. And we make short-term financially based decisions all the time. That's what our overly financialized world has come to look like pretty much across the board. So we make these short-term financial decisions. People are not thinking about the long term. They're not thinking about the actual availability of resources and what shortages of resources actually mean in practice in so many parts of the world. So there's a critical longer term view that's already being lost. I'm trying very hard to try to get people to look at that longer term, to look at the actual implications of how these short term things play out in the long term.
So by continuing to have these short-term perspectives, a lot of the choices that are being made continue to be extractive.
Yes, you're quite right. They do turn out to be extremely extractive. It's all about the short term. It's all about continuing to remove as much as we can, to consume as much as we can today, even although in doing so, we deprive our children and grandchildren of a future. Because what we're doing in our period of bubble economy, we are bringing demand forward so that we get to use and enjoy the fruits of everything now, even although that means there will be very, very little left in the future. That is a decision I don't think we truly understand as a species, but that is the reality we're facing. Our overconsumption today is depriving our children of a future tomorrow.
One of the things that has become a recurring theme recently in some of the conversations that I've been having with guests is the way in which we view the world and how that impacts our decisions, whether we have a human-centered approach versus an intergenerational equality approach versus having a biocentric approach, whether we're concerned about just ourselves or ourselves and future generations or all life on Earth, and the impacts that those have on our ability to think between the short term, the long term, and make good decisions as a result of that.
That is critically important as a perspective, to say that we need to know what time frame we mentally operate over collectively. Now, individually, people are able to look at the longer term and to work out what the impacts are of today's decisions on tomorrow's reality. Collectively, as our societies, we don't seem to be able to do that. We only look at the short term. We only look at our own bottom line today And the people who are engaged in accumulating as much as they can today are not thinking about the future at all. But because they control so many of the resources, the decisions made by these relatively few people are determining where things go at the moment. So we've just put extractive industries into absolute overdrive, and consequences be damned. We're not looking at the environmental impacts. We're not looking at the extent of the limits, the extent of the structural dependencies we're creating for ourselves. And we're not thinking in terms of where do we go from here when we can no longer live within these limits. And those limits start to put very non-negotiable ceilings on what we're capable of achieving. So we're not looking at what the downside is. People are making money today and only thinking about the next quarter even, not even the next year. They're making extremely short-term decisions that are leaving the future in a very uncertain state where inevitably there are going to be major dislocations to the downside, and those are going to have very widespread impact. So it's not that life won't be worth living or that we can't somehow negotiate this. Of course we can, but it doesn't mean we're going to have a future that looks anything remotely like the present or even the relatively recent past. It means that we're going to have to find a completely different accommodation with the way we expect to live, that we're going to have very much simpler societies and a very much lower material standard of living. Inevitably, business as usual is no longer an option. It's critically dependent on cheap energy and cheap credit. Those are going away, which means we cannot have what we have now. We need to start looking right now at what we can have, and looking at what is within our own power to control locally in terms of delivering basic human needs. Because that we can do. Permaculture is a big part of the answer to that, for instance. So we can look at building food forests and being good shepherds of soil fertility and maintaining the ability of our environment to sustain life in our local areas. But every local area will have to do it for itself because there won't be any top-down solutions. That whole top-down level of governance will no longer function. We're going to have to look at bottom-up governance from the grassroots and say, what can we do? How can we provide for food and water and shelter for the largest number of people? And there is a lot we can do. We don't have to buy into the current extremely expensive system. But trying to get from where we are now to where we are inevitably going is going to involve a very large dislocation, and a lot of people are not prepared for that at all. One of the things that I try to do around the world is to explain to people what the future is likely to look like and how they can start to make moves to prepare for that now, how they can move in that direction so that they can be less exposed to a whole range of structural dependencies. The less exposed you are to dependencies, the less vulnerable you will be. And the more people in any given area who think this way and move in that direction, the less vulnerable whole local areas will be.
So you see this as a move to a relocalization of government and community building between neighbors in order to have communities that revolve around mutual aid with one another?
Absolutely. That is what can work. In times where there's almost no money and very little energy around, very little resources, people need to depend on each other. No man is an island. And if we insist on looking at these things from an acutely individual perspective, which is a very Anglo-Saxon thing to do, then we will trap ourselves in ways that we did not need to be trapped. If we look at it in a more collective way, at a local level, bottom-up building community self-sufficiency, there is a great deal that we can do. But it absolutely must rest on a foundation of trust at the community level. People need to get together and get to know each other right now in order to build social capital so that they have a solid foundation to build a different future upon. This is absolutely critical. This is a big part of the lectures that I give worldwide, is looking at how do you build community initiatives that are the one thing that has a reasonable chance of making a difference.
So what do you see the future looking like, both on the impact of these crises and, if you will, like an idealized local economy?
Well, it's very hard to say. It's going to vary an awful lot depending on where in the world you are, because when you can't even out disparities with trade anymore, then your local reality becomes your only reality. So it depends what you happen to have or not have, wherever you happen to be. So those local realities will look drastically different depending on things like resource availability. So how much energy is there in the local area? How much water? What do you have to do to provide food and water to people locally? What kind of infrastructure is there? What kind of state of repair is it in? What kind of resources would have to go into keeping it functioning at some basic minimal kind of level? How do you provide for shelter? There's so many things that will vary locally, and people are going to have to create their local reality in accordance with their local circumstances. I would suggest that people take an inventory of the things that they use and rely on and say, how many of these things do we produce here? How many of these things would we not have if global trade takes an enormous fall, which it always does in a depression? It fell enormously in the Great Depression of the 1930s. So if people look at their situation and say, what do we have to provide the basics, and how much of it do we make here? Then they might be able to say, okay, these are the critical things that we don't make here. Maybe we should think about making them here in order that we will still have the ability to provide for this basic need in the future. So the more you can plan in advance, the more you may be able to build resilience. I realize it's much easier to say this than it is to do it. So actually being able to put this into practice is very difficult. And in some parts of the world, be far more difficult than other parts. But nevertheless, if people start thinking that way sooner rather than later, they may be able to mitigate the impact of the failure of these large-scale centralized systems that we currently rely on.
So a place we might begin with that is in our own home. As I sit here and think about the systems that I rely on regularly, rather than continuing to just spend money in the consumer cycle and look at these like next things on the horizon, I might look around and go, okay, well, I use a well primarily for water, so let's consider getting some of the parts and skills that are necessary to repair that so that I could fix that if that breaks.
Yes, and a manual well pump, for instance, or a spare well pump, or some way to produce the electricity or store the electricity you would need to run a well pump, because water is one of the absolutely fundamental critical things. Your house would become uninhabitable very quickly if you could no longer run your well when that's your only source of water. So absolutely, think about redundancy. Think about how many different ways could you provide for the same essential thing. And if you have to keep your well going, you would need to think of multiple different ways that that might work and try and provide the infrastructure for doing that so that you will still be able to provide for that basic function. And the same thing can be said for all other functions. When I look at cooking, for instance, at the farm where I've been based for the last 13 years in Ontario, so I think of the ways that I would be able to cook. Well, I can cook on an electric range with mains power. I can cook in a toaster oven run by a generator. I can cook on a wood-fired aga in my kitchen from the early 1920s, so no power required. I can cook with butane on a Coleman stove. I can cook with propane on a barbecue. I can use a solar cooker. I could set up a tripod and cook with a Dutch oven over an open fire. So there are multiple different ways. And not the infrastructure for doing that is actually particularly expensive. But having those various different bits of infrastructure available allows me to be able to say, come what may, almost, I can still cook. So there are so many different ways in which we can take that same mentality into our lives and say, how do you provide for the essential functions? What are the things that are truly essential, needs as opposed to wants? How do we satisfy them now? What dependencies do we have that allow us to do that? And how could we reduce that range of dependencies? That's the kind of thinking I think people really need to take.
And as we have that mindset and begin to invest within our own home to have that resiliency, I think of the permaculture zone model, that if we think of that zero as our home, as we begin to increase resiliency in our home, well, then that makes the neighborhood that we live in a little bit more resilient because of the skills and abilities that we have to aid our neighbors in time of need. And if we help them get that mindset as our neighborhood becomes more resilient in that kind of like zone one right around us, then zone two becomes a little bit more resilient as we have less need for these larger social structures, and we can have a lot of influence very close to ourselves to help ourselves and others.
That's the critical mindset to develop. Permaculture has a huge amount to offer in this regard.
We've covered the financial impact, the energy impact, what we can do to help build resiliency in many regards. I do have one question from a listener that I'd like to wrap up this main section of the interview with before I ask you for final thoughts. Do you mind if I go ahead and read that?
Go right ahead.
All right. James asks, if Nicole had a crystal ball, I'd like to know how much longer the status quo in terms of banking, energy, agriculture, and so on will continue. If I had that time frame, it would help me make real decisions in my life. Maybe she could narrow it down a bit, months, years, decades. I'd settle for her best guess, if she's willing to offer it.
Well, I don't think the status quo in financial terms is going to last much longer. In fact, if you live in the European periphery, you've already lost it. So it depends where you are. I would say the U.S. is kind of teetering on the brink at the moment, and various other parts of the world are in different stages of expansion or contraction. Europe is leading the way. So if you're in Europe, you already have to assume the status quo is over as of right now, or possibly as of a few years ago, depending on where you are. If you're in North America, you have to assume that it's ending pretty much now. And because it takes time to extract yourself from that kind of overexposed position that most of ourselves find ourselves in, even if it didn't happen tomorrow, even if it took another year, the time to prepare is still now, because it will take at least that long to prepare, to get oneself into a position of not being so dependent on current systems. People who are sitting there thinking the status quo will continue and thinking, well, we don't have to prepare until we actually see things start to happen in our own neighborhood, they're going to find that by the time they realize something needs to be prepared for, it will be too late to do it. So I think people have to look at the situation now and say, we have been warned. We know what's coming. We know we're moving into economic contraction. We have to start right now to do something about it, to get ourselves out of harm's way, get as much personal control over whatever assets we control as we possibly can, to wean ourselves off whatever dependencies we possibly can, and to do it right now. So I think that's far more important as a perspective than saying, when might there actually be a systemic banking crisis? We came very close to it in September 2008. We came within hours of crashing the global banking system. We probably won't be so lucky the next time that happens. The Bank of International Settlements already, within the last month or so, issued a warning on interbank lending rates, which means that banks are losing confidence in their own counterparties. So they're peers, if you like. When you get to the point where banks are starting to mistrust each other as repositories for loans for perhaps a shorter period as 24 hours, then you know that fear is in the ascendancy again, exactly as it was in 2008. So we're moving into the next phase of financial crisis. We simply can't assume that the status quo is going to last any longer at all. And if we act as if it will continue, even for a few more weeks, then we keep ourselves in harm's way and we impair our ability to prepare, because preparation will inevitably take time. So we need to say, we know this is coming. We can't pinpoint an exact date. Only the insiders will get more than a handful of hours' notice anyway. So we can't hinge everything we do on waiting to see if things break one way or the other. I think the big picture is quite clear. We know which way things are going to break. We can already see it happening in various parts of the world where the situation is very comparable. They're just going over the edge sooner. But I think we need to look and learn the lessons of the places that are already in the thick of it, so that we can prepare ourselves right now. So we have an opportunity, an unprecedented opportunity, to learn the lessons of history and actually do something about it in advance. No other generation has ever had that opportunity. This is an opportunity we absolutely cannot afford to waste.
So the time to take action is now.
Absolutely right now.
With all this, with all that you see on the horizon, are you still hopeful that we can bring about a positive change?
Oh, I'm very hopeful we can bring about a positive change. But I should qualify that by saying We cannot maintain business as usual. It's over. We have to get over expecting the future to look like the present or even the recent past. So by offering solutions, I am not pretending to offer something that will continue the status quo or in any way maintain business as usual. In terms of moving in a positive direction, however, yes, absolutely we can do that. If you look at the trajectory we were on, with the hyper-extraction, the huge amount of externalities, the growth overproduction of everything, the extent to which we were exceeding carrying capacity, we were on an extremely pathological trajectory that was leading us into destruction and also putting more and more power in the hands of fewer and fewer people who then had less and less reason to care about the rest of humanity. So where we were going was actually not a good thing. It led to a certain increase in material prosperity for an ever smaller number of people. But this is not something to be celebrated as a status quo worth maintaining. We need to look at how we can actually live in balance with what our environment can hope to deliver by way of maintaining us. So, yes, we can move into a much better balance. Looking at permaculture principles, exactly, that kind of design process, the way that we can move in the direction of looking at what we have that sustains us, how we can design it to live within a system rather than assume we are separate from that system and somehow completely in charge of it. We need to look back at seeing ourselves as part of an ecosystem, the way people in the distant past would once have done. So not to see ourselves as totally masters of a system, but to look at our role within it. And I think that is a very, very positive message. It doesn't mean there won't be painful dislocations. Of course there will, no matter what we do. But we can mitigate the impact. We can reduce the human overreaction to events if we prepare in advance. And we do have the intellectual tools to build a different kind of future. There's a tremendous amount of energy at the community level in various parts of the world. People want to come together. People want to do things differently. They're just looking for information as to how they might be able to do that. And I think there's so much out there that we can bring people that does actually offer a significant amount of hope. We just have to get our expectations in line with reality, in line with what reality can hope to deliver. And that reality is in retreat at the moment. So our expectations must also be in retreat. But we shouldn't be just thinking about it in terms of what we would lose. Yes, we will have a lower material standard of prosperity. But look at it in terms of what we can gain. We can rediscover what it means to be human. Moving into an era where people are working together again, they build community again, they build interdependence. We lost so much of that in our period of expansion. We have the potential to regain that. And that's what actually makes people happy every year. It's not new iPads all the time that make people happy. It's building community. It's coming together and working together. And I think that is my profoundly hopeful message for the future. If I didn't think there was any hope, I wouldn't be going around telling people the sort of things that I'm telling them. I want them to actually be able to reach out and grasp the opportunities that are open to them while those are still open.
Thank you for bringing us to that point and sharing that hopeful perspective. One of the things that drew me to permaculture was that it has a positive approach to building a better world, that even with all of the things that kind of served as the focal points to start this design system off with issues of carrying capacity and energy, that it still focuses on, in the long term, about permanent human civilization and in turn culture, that we will still have these other things of value within community beyond just subsistence living. And I'm glad to hear your viewpoint on that. And as I've had you for quite a while, and we've covered everything that I was interested in, at least at this moment in our conversation, is there anything else that you would like to add to the discussion for the listeners before we bring everything to a close?
I would very much like to connect grassroots organizations all over the world, because there's so many things that are happening in different places for different reasons that are profoundly positive. I would like to hear from people who are doing things on the ground that make a difference in their local area. Now, they may feel this is small and insignificant and it's only happening in this little village, so why would it matter? But these things absolutely do matter, because what works in one place can be transplanted to places that are similar in terms of resources and outlook. So I think bringing people together, connecting these small-scale grassroots initiatives, is going to be extremely important. This is really what we need to use our information technology for while we still have that capacity, to look at what people are doing in different places and see what works, see why it works, and try and spread best practice wherever we possibly can.
Well, thank you, Nicole, for that. And thank you for taking this time out of your day in your journeys as we have this conversation across 6 time zones. And it's morning where I am and afternoon where you are. Thank you so much for all of this and everything that you had to share. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that was Nicole Foss. I'm thankful that Nicole is still hopeful about the future. Even with these looming issues, we still have time to take action to build resiliency and prepare for these and other eventualities. The path to do so isn't hard, but does require a different outlook and investment in our daily lives and personal stability. Permaculture provides many of the tools necessary to design and plan a way forward. Nicole wanted me to let you know that, in addition to her current world tour, for anyone in the United States, she's looking to do a tour around the nation later this year. If you'd like her to stop by your town for a talk, contact her and discuss the possibility. Her email address is automaticearth@gmail.com. If you're left with thoughts or questions after listening to this show, feel free to reach me by email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266. You can also send me a message on the Facebook page for the show, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. Up next week, on August 27th, will, hopefully, be Dr. Laura Jackson. Though the interview is recorded, I'm waiting for some feedback from her. She and I talk about the modern agriculture system, including the structures that lock farmers into commodity crops and slows our ability to change the way we grow food. After that, on September 3rd, is Keith Johnson of the Permaculture Activist. We have a general conversation about the state of permaculture in the world. And on September 10th, my birthday, Wilson Alvarez and Ben Wise talk about Zone 4 permaculture and how we can use the semi-wild space to build a better world. Some other notes. The winner of the drawing for a copy of Nikki Jabor's The Year-Round Vegetable Gardener has been notified, and the book should be to them shortly. I also contacted the winner for the drawing of my copy of Ben Falk's The Resilient Farm and Homestead. I'm waiting to hear from them so this can be sent out as well. Lastly for this episode, I'll post an updated release schedule to the Facebook page in a few days, as I now have enough interviews recorded to release new episodes through the end of November, a plan for when each of those will come out, and more guests in the pipeline. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And the legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it. Just tell people where you got it from and don't change or sell it.